You're listening to Commute, the podcast. Congratulations, you'll be smarter when you get there.
What up? Welcome into Commute, the podcast. I'm Dave.
And I'm Jay.
And we are about to take you on a deep dive on three topics that we find interesting, and we're betting that you might just find them interesting too. We can promise you this, you'll be smarter when you get there. On this edition of Commute, you may not have ever thought about it, but almost all hotels and nearly all airlines skip the number 13. Why? It's not all for the reason that you think.
If you grew up in a certain era and went to American public schools, you're probably familiar with or were traumatized by the presidential physical fitness test from your time in elementary school. But where did this bizarre test come from and what happened to it?
Do you consider yourself a bird watcher? Well, a lot of people do. But what is it about watching these little flying animals that draws so many of us in? All of that on this edition of Commute. Let's get it. Well, Jay, we made it. Episode 150. 150 commute episodes. Well done, my friend.
That's pretty wild stuff. I mean, when we started it back in the day, you know, up to now.
Hard to believe. Yeah, wild. And if you are among the growing number of people who have joined as a commute listener, we would love to take this opportunity to have you rate, subscribe, and review the show if you haven't done so. That helps us reach other people. And Jay, it is cool. We have grown our audience a lot over these 150 episodes, and hopefully we'll continue to grow as we move forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, with that, Jay, let's get into episode number 150 of Commute the Podcast. So, Jay, my friend, according to a recent report from a survey all about luck and superstition, 68% of Americans believe in the concept of luck, with 31% saying they regularly do things they perceive as potentially influential over their good or bad luck because, quote, we just want to be on the safe side. So how about you, Jay? Are you superstitious or do you consider yourself maybe just a little stitious?
No, I'm a man of science, you know, so I don't necessarily walk around thinking about superstitions. But at the same time, I'll be watching a game, you know, like the Packers or something, and be thinking about how, like, man, if I would have put this hoodie on, if I would have put this hoodie on, like, maybe the game would have gone a different way. So, you know, in my brain, no, but I guess in my heart, sometimes.
Well, yeah, I wasn't going to let you lie on that one, because I have been around you before where you're like, hey, I can't move from the seat. Like, things are just going too
well. Yeah, that is true.
And I think that that's a lot of us. I mean, I don't think I'm all that superstitious, but if things are going well, I mean, I kind of acknowledge that, hey, like, I don't want to change this situation. You know, why leave something to chance? And Jay, a lot of superstitious situations involve numbers, right? Like, something costs $6.66. We might want to throw on, like, a drink or a stick of gum to the order, just in case the devil really thinks maybe we're trying to signal him, you know? Another is the number 13 and the perceived unlucky nature surrounding that number. In fact, Jay, did you know most hotels don't have a 13th floor and most airlines don't have a 13th row? And when it comes to hotels, what you would guess to be the case is actually true. They don't feature a 13th floor because, well, people don't really want to stay on a potentially unlucky floor, you know, just in case. So is it the same story for most airlines? Well, yes and no. In 2023, United Airlines spokesperson Linda Jojo told the Washington Post that the lack of row 13 has more to do with the company adding Braille for its seeing-impaired customers than with a perceived unluckiness. Jojo said that most United planes don't feature the number 13 because it makes using Braille to find your seat somewhat difficult. Travel and Leisure also reported that airlines skip 13 for another key reason: to present uniformity in their accommodations. For example, the Boeing 737 doesn't have rows numbered 4, 5, or 6 because they want to provide more space for the first class customers in rows 1, 2, and 3. Whatever the reasons, though, Jay, people just don't trust the number 13. That much is true. And according to Travel and Leisure, much of it comes down to triskaidekaphobia. I'm sure I got that right. Or the very real fear of the number 13. Jay, it's been reported that up to, get this, 13% of the population suffers from this phobia, with many others just preferring not to leave anything to chance when it comes to the unlucky number. A fear of 13 is also born out of multiple examples throughout history. A Norse mythology, for example, tells the story of the god of mischief, Loki, for you Marvel fans, once storming a dinner party, leaving destruction in his wake in the form of 13 deaths. In the Bible, its infamous Last Supper attendee, Judas Iscariot, the betrayer of Jesus, was the 13th to appear at the meal. Other examples include the steps to the gallows when someone was sentenced to death, 13, or the supposed number of witches in a coven, also 13. And of course, we can't leave out Friday the 13th, a horror movie franchise featuring an unkillable monster in a ski mask named Jason Voorhees, and the overall kind of spooky nature of the day when it appears on our calendars. So Jay, true or not, 13 is often villainized as a negative number, an indicator of potentially bad things to come. So what do you think? Does it matter, or maybe we should avoid 13 just to be safe?
The 666 thing at the register is true. I mean, anytime I've worked any sort of thing, job that's required me to take money, that happens so much more often than you think it does. Like the customer sees that their total is $6.66 and they're like, oh gosh, I need to add something else. And I always thought, like, what do you think the devil is? You know, like, do you think he's like down there and he's like, got him? He's got like, just because you got that cheeseburger, like, before this moment, I didn't have access and now I do.
People picture it more like, or at least I do, that he's sitting in like a call center. And when something hits 666, one of the phone rings. So it's signaling him like, oh, like maybe someone's trying to send me a signal to do something bad in this specific place. Like, I mean, that's how I see it. Like, right, he's got his feet up. He's in like a very hot living room, bunch of phones. And when they go off, he just decides to answer or not. That's kind of what it
is. There's a business decision here. Like, make your most popular, like, two items add up to $6.66. So you'll like get more people to add more to their total. Like, that's an untapped market. So Dave, both you and I went to elementary school in the same era, and I think if you listen to this podcast, there's a pretty good chance that you grew up in that same era. And during this time, there was a test that you would be given across the country in elementary school called the Presidential Physical Fitness Test. And it was something that was just sort of commonplace. Like, you took it and they would give you these like awards. Like, there was like a yellow badge, a red badge, and a blue badge. And the blue badge was like you were in the top like 10% or something. And then red was like you did okay. And then I think the yellow was labeled participant. I have a few of those myself, and those were the those are the ones that you showed up, you know,
like, yeah, this kid's not that fit.
and it wasn't until we got older that we started thinking back on it, because a lot of the things that are used to measure, it's strange. It's like, how many pull-ups can you do as a 7-year-old? It's like, well, not many, because I'm 7, you know. Or like the thing where they would set a measurement in front of you and you'd have to kind of sit your legs in a V, and then you have to reach forward and see how flexible you were, like how far can you get, or how many sit-ups can you do. And I think I already know how you're going to describe yourself in these tests, but I always like dreaded these tests. I didn't really like start to get into sports until a little bit later, like late middle school, high school, because I was always behind, like growth wise. You know, I was shorter, like smaller. And so I just did not do good on these tests. Like, I didn't have the tools in the toolbox to do pull-ups, you know. For you though, I kind of imagine you probably had a different experience, if I had to guess.
I was just gonna let you go for as long as you wanted to make an excuse of why you weren't good at the presidential fitness test. I lived for the presidential fitness test. As soon as summer began, I started training for the next year's physical fitness test. In fact, one year I didn't realize the mile run, which was my favorite part of the physical fitness test, that it was a certain day. And so I faked sick to go to the principal's office to call my mom to bring me some shorts so I could run fat. That's true. It's 100% true. So I could run a faster time. To say she was mad about it is an understatement. But I'll tell you what, she did bring the shorts, and I did have the class record for the mile run, so it all worked out.
Yeah, how much slower do you think that time would have been if you would have had to run in jeans or whatever?
20, 30 seconds, maybe even a minute.
Well, Dave, if you didn't grow up during a certain era, this presidential physical fitness test was a demonstration of physical fitness for elementary students that lasted in the United States for actual decades. Students were tested on running, sit-ups, pull-ups, stretching, and many other tests, and then awarded a level based on their performance. But then, as suddenly as it appeared, it vanished. So what even was the presidential physical fitness test? Where did it come from? And, well, where did it go? Well, like a lot of things in our world today, Dave, the presidential physical fitness test grew out of national defense fears. In the 1950s, there were some big changes in American life that were really causing our society to reevaluate itself at all sorts of levels. We were in the middle of the Cold War with Russia, and we were losing the space race by 1957. This raised a fear in Americans that maybe the country wasn't closing a mental gap with the Soviet Union, and that their schools were churning out much smarter kids than ours. But in the eyes of many, there was also a physical gap between the two sides of the Cold War. Our society had embraced new technology, like better transportation systems, which kept us sitting in our cars longer, and nearly every American household had a television, which kept us inside on the couch longer. The first nationwide studies on nutrition also began to be gathered in the 1950s too, because in the decade before World War II, it was estimated that a third of all men rejected for the draft were rejected due to improper nutrition, most likely caused by the economy of the Great Depression. The interest finally met action when Senator James Duff from Pennsylvania, along with several sports and medical figures, met with President Dwight Eisenhower in 1955 and revealed something shocking to him. According to research, nearly 58% of American youth failed at least one of the six mobility tests administered, while only 8.7% of European children failed at least one test. This freaked Eisenhower out, and he signed an executive order in 1955 that started the President's Council on Youth Fitness, with then Vice President Richard Nixon as the chairman. In 1958, the first youth fitness test standards were unveiled: a shuttle run, a 50-yard dash, a 600-yard run or walk, pull-ups, standing long jump, sit-ups, and a softball throw, which not coincidentally is the same skill set needed to throw a hand grenade. Now, when Eisenhower left office and John F. Kennedy came in, the council was expanded, complete with advertising campaigns for physical fitness. And then when Lyndon Johnson replaced Kennedy, the council evolved further, implementing the Presidential Physical Fitness Award, which was given to students who scored in the 85th percentile or higher in a series of tests. And the Presidential Physical Fitness Test and the trauma was born. And for some, Dave, traumatic it was. The worst part of the fitness test for an out-of-shape kid wasn't the actual exercise, Roger Sherman wrote on SB Nation. It was the fact that everybody in your class saw you trying to exercise and saw how bad you were at it. So many of us were humiliated. And Dave, one of the issues here is that the test didn't really measure anything gym teachers didn't already know. In fact, many gym teachers, in speaking to various media outlets over the years, have pointed out that the test was embarrassing for students and pointed out their weaknesses in front of all of their classmates. In 2012, the president's physical fitness test was replaced with the Presidential Youth Fitness Program as part of a new initiative called Let's Move. And while it does include an assessment, the parameters are much different, and the program is meant to instruct more than it is to test. There's a more holistic mindset today when thinking about what fitness even is and what it can be for everyone, and how essentially it can be different for everyone, teaching kids that and then explaining the benefits of healthy choices rather than seeing who can do the most pull-ups.
Even as somebody who loved the presidential physical fitness test, I will tell you the sit and reach was not fair. Because I have somewhat short arms. I was always going to miss that one.
That was your white whale. That was the one.
I'd get it because I'd cheat a little bit to get it.
Not surprised by that at all.
I can say that now. I will say, though, was there anything more sad than when somebody who you knew and they knew that they couldn't do a pull-up
but they were going to try it.
That was me. So, I'm telling you, like, that was so me.
So they went and hung on the bar long as they could.
That was literally me. And like, we had it's insane to think about now, but we had a rope in our gym that was so unsafe that went all the way to the ceiling. And there was a bell at the top. Like I'm in the Marines or something. And I'm like six.
I remember, my sixth grade year. It's kind of like your senior year, you know, if you're a college athlete. Because back when I was in sixth grade, that you were still in elementary school. So it was like you everything built to when I'm in sixth grade, man, I'm going to run the school, you know, that kind of thing. I remember I was so amped for the mile run. Because like, I've been waiting for this, the Super Bowl, waiting for this one. And I'm going to get sub 7 minutes on this one. And I won't say his full name. I'm sure he doesn't listen to the show. I'm going to say his full name, Stephen Cozart, because he needs to know. he was going so slow on the mile run, I couldn't get around him. I couldn't get around. I mean, he probably cost me 20 to 30 seconds, because every lap, we had to run laps in the gym, every lap, Stephen Cozart, he was just in the way.
I need to do some research on who I need to call to get your presidential status revoked anyway for that cheating admission that just happened. Like, you need to go from blue to red, I think. That's what that sounds like.
And Jay, finally this week, do you have a movie-going experience that stands out to you? Like a memory of going to a specific movie, the experience of being in the theater for that movie? Like one we shared together was when we went to see the Christopher Nolan movie Tenet as our first return trip after the pandemic, and it was just you and me in the theater, and it was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's never happened since, you know, never had an empty theater, but it was like, yeah, it was like fresh. I think it was like June or something of 2020. Yeah. So it was like, right.
We could just talk like normally to each other.
Yeah, that definitely stands out. That was a unique experience going to the theater. But I've always appreciated, it seems like it hasn't really happened as much since, but I always appreciated like event films. Like, you know, you're seeing something and it's maybe the end of like a trilogy, or it's like the end of like a series, and there's a lot of people in there and everybody's sort of reacting to it. So like, I think about like times that I've seen like Star Wars installments, or like the third, like Lord of the Rings, maybe back in the mid 2000s. Like, that was a big experience.
Well, another for me is when I went to see the movie Dodgeball, which I'm sure you've seen. Ben Stiller, yes. Vince Vaughn, comedy movie about the sport of dodgeball. I laughed so hard, like seeing that in the theater, it just kind of stands out to me. Well, one thing that movie did was it kind of made these more obscure sports like dodgeball part of the national conversation, at least in jest. Like, obviously poking fun that people would watch dodgeball on ESPN. And what's funny is, you know, little did anyone know that when the world shut down during COVID, including most athletic events not happening, we would actually be watching dodgeball on ESPN. It would actually be something that we would do, like in the movie. But Jay, something else happened during that time period too. According to some reports, something you could definitely call an obscure sport became the number one sport in America in terms of participation, with nearly 50 million people reported to be active participants following the year 2020. And now, years after the pandemic, it has continued to soar in popularity, no pun intended. Jay, that sport? Bird watching, or birding, as it is called by many participants. Jay, once again spiking during the pandemic for people looking for a safe, free, and outdoor hobby, birding exploded in 2020 and hasn't looked back. Researchers have long sought to understand the appeal and perks of simply observing birds, and a recent study published in Scientific Reports has delivered. According to the study, seeing or hearing birds is linked to improving people's mental well-being for up to 8 hours. Of those studied, people who suffered from depression or another mood disorder experienced, quote, significant improvements in their quality of life. And Jay, while this study was all about birding, it was not the first study of its kind. A 2020 study by Ecological Economics found that observing up to 14 different bird species was just as satisfying, get this, just as satisfying to the human brain as earning an extra $150 per month. Another study by the Journal of Environmental Psychology found that of all the natural sounds you can hear, a bird singing is most closely associated with stress recovery and attention restoration. But Jay, regardless of what the stats say, I think it might be best to hear from a birder about why they do it and what steps they take to be successful in attracting the types of birds worth journaling about. So I called up our buddy Jared, a doctor, a family man, and a birder, to hear from him. All right, so Jared, let's start here. How did you become a birder?
Well, when I was in graduate
school, do you accept that title of birder? Like, do you like being called a birder?
I consider myself less of a birder and more of a backyard bird feeding enthusiast. How about that?
Okay. But how did you get started being a birder for me? We'll call you a birder.
Well, when I was in college, I worked part-time for a local store called Wild Birds Unlimited. And to do that job, as I was getting trained, there was software that was on a CD-ROM on a computer in the back of the store, in which I had to take courses to become a backyard bird feeding specialist.
Riveting. How necessary is the feed, the quality of feed? Because my wife is getting into bird watching, and you have been, I'll just say, detrimental to my budget because you've been encouraging her to get more expensive seed.
Well, I mean, Dave, how would you feel if you ate McDonald's every single day? Not well, right? A lot of it would go to waste. So I was at a barbecue in Dave's backyard, and I looked over, and I was appalled to find the quality of seed that they were feeding. There was all kinds of filler. There was millet. There was a bunch of waste that was just going to be on the ground, creating a huge mess. The birds don't want to eat it.
If somebody were interested in getting into birding like yourself, and they were wanting to find some like-minded bird heads, which I assume is what you call other people who bird. How would they go about doing this?
Well, so if people want to actually get into bird watching where they leave their house and take binoculars and go find birds, there's I can imagine that, you know, there are ways to do that to become a part of a greater group. The National Audubon Society has different particular days where people go out all on the same day and do a bird watch. Probably their most famous or popular one is the Christmas bird count.
So what is it about watching birds that you like?
Well, our setup at home, we've got three or four bird feeders right outside our bedroom window. And it's always fun to watch the different birds that come in, see the activity before a storm or a snowstorm's coming. It gets a lot more active. On the eastern part of the United States, we will get migratory birds that come around bird feeders or bird baths. They're not always here.
Given the choice between watching a really good television show or watching some birds, would you choose some birds?
I don't watch a whole lot of TV. I guess it really would depend on the setting.
So you'd choose some birds is kind of how I take that.
Sure, yeah, if you'd like to make that your interpretation.
Okay. This has been very enlightening. Thank you for your time.
Well, I'm glad to share my joy in backyard bird feeding with you, Dave.
Well, there you have it, Jay. And going back to the research, next time you wish you made more money, the research does say that you're better off listening to birds than asking for a raise. So just some food for thought.
This seems like a boss somewhere wrote that. Like this. It's like, well, actually, did you know that actually
Jay, you're valuable,
instead of a raise,
buddy, but
it's like when they have these big corporate meetings with like people who are in charge, they're like, listen, we got the perfect way to deny your work as a raise. Just hear me out.
And that's it. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate, subscribe, and review Commute on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast network. We're on social. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can always say what up at our website, commutethepodcast.com. Music for Commute is provided by my main man, Jason Sammons. For Jay Sisson, I'm Dave Traub. We'll see you next week.
This reminds me of seventh grade, whenever I was in this thing called Science Olympiad, which is like a science competition where like you join, like you have a team and you have different events, and we needed a team to for bird identification was one of the was like one of the events. And like basically what would happen is you had to be so familiar with birds that you would hear their calls and then you'd be able to identify which call was a certain type of bird. And of course, like I was like, sure, I'll do it. Like, how hard can it be? And just totally put it on the back burner and worked on other events. And so I got to the competition and bombed so hard. Like I still remember sitting in it and this like recording was like bird number 6. And it would just be like, you know, it's like, I have no idea. Okay. A heron, I guess.
It's a sparrow.
And then it'd be like bird number 7. And it's like, wah! And you're just like, I have literally no idea. It was humbling.